You're tuned to RTE Radio 1.
Welcome to The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. You can get in touch by email bookshow@rte.ie or tweet us at bookshowrte. This is our last episode this season, so we thought we'd ease you into the summer with a packed show. But first, congratulations to Juan Gabriel Vasquez for winning the International Impact Dublin Literary Award this week for his book, The Sound of Things Falling. As today is Father's Day, we'd also like to help some of our male listeners get in touch with their emotions, thanks to a very special book of poetry. Director Mike Lee, Richard Dawkins, Melvin Bragg and Ian McCune will all be reading from a new collection, Poems to Make Grown Men Cry. We'll explore the diseased and fractured Dublin of John Kelly's new novel, From Out of the City. But first this evening, we're going to step outside. Tomorrow is Bloomsday, and people all over Dublin and cities around the world will be walking these streets, sausages in one hand, boaters in the other. Throngs of them outside Davy Byrne's pub, quoting Ulysses and paying homage to Joyce. Ulysses is Ireland's walking novel.
You have this disjunction between a human scale city and a mechanical scale city with the body interposed.
Its hero, Leopold Bloom, walks from Eccles Street on the north side around the city and back home with Stephen Dedalus at the end of a long day and night. But why does Bloom walk in Ulysses?
I think the greatness of Ulysses is partly that when you walk through streets, you encounter strangeness, the unexpected.
Why have some of the best fiction and essay writers used walking as a device?
William Hazlitt.
James Joyce.
Virginia Woolf.
J.M. Singh.
Jane Austen.
Nabokov.
Ian Sinclair.
Gertrude Stein.
And what can walking tell us about ourselves?
To walk 3 miles, above her ankles in dirt, and alone, quite alone. What could she mean by it?
I want to know what connects writers and walkers, and which streets are paved with literary greats. To find out, I'll take a walk around New York with Teju Cole.
A novel is like taking a mirror for a walk down the street. It becomes a way of capturing the flow of life.
Get a history of walking and writing with Rebecca Solnit.
Just as therapists say no two people live in the same family, no two people live in the same city. We each have our own associations. The city becomes a book you read, but none of us read quite the same book.
And explore London with Will Self.
I never feel I know a city until I've actually walked right across it, or at the very least from the centre into its hinterland.
And as we stroll across three cities, we find out how plots emerge from the routes writers take and how we can unravel our own identity from things we encounter in the streets and on the page. But first, we're headed back to the 18th century to meet essayist William Hazlitt.
One of the pleasantest things in the world is going on a journey.
The gruff Hazlitt was one of the first to write in English about the pleasures, or otherwise, of walking.
But I like to go by myself. I can enjoy society in a room, but out of doors, nature is company enough for me. I am then never less alone than when alone.
Hazlitt may have liked being alone, but there were times when he wasn't as alone as he pretended. One man who found this out was philosopher A.C. Grayling. He's written a biography of William Hazlitt, and part of the writing involved walking in his supposed footsteps.
I love to walk, and that's one reason why I retraced Hazlitt's steps all the way from Wem in Shropshire down to Netherstowey in Somerset, which is where he'd been invited to spend part of a summer with Coleridge and Wordsworth, just at the time they were drafting the lyrical ballads. And in fact, Hazlitt saw them in manuscript. Now, that's a distance of about 120 miles, and I walked them all. And halfway through, while I was struggling through a big nettle patch, I was puzzling over why Hazlitt took such an odd route, because he went from Shrewsbury to Worcester to Gloucester to Bristol, where he could have just gone down the Welsh marches and caught the ferry at Chepstow across to the Somerset shore. And I realised it was because he had gone by coach. But anyway, I enjoyed my walking tour.
Do you ever work out problems and issues at your books by going out for a walk?
Oh, I very, very often think through some knot in what I'm writing, or when I'm certainly when I'm thinking about a book before I begin writing, I like to go for walks. Hazlitt himself was a great walker. He used to say that the soles of your feet really got your mind going, and he was absolutely right about it.
So even though one avid journeyman writer sometimes took the easy option, plenty of writers do walk, and in groups, like biographer and writer Margaret Drabble.
I do walk a lot by myself, and I think while I'm walking. And sometimes when I'm walking, I'm enjoying myself, and I think I ought to do a bit of plot thinking. And sometimes I just walk, and sometimes as you're walking along, an idea drops into your head, and you don't. I never take a pencil or a bit of paper. What I sometimes do when I walk up to the church in the evening, I have been known to steal a piece out of the visitor's book and write a note on it, and then I go back and guiltily drop a pound in the tin. But I should take a pencil and a piece of paper, wouldn't I? Because, yes, I do have ideas as I go.
For Margaret, walking has its highs and lows.
I walk a lot by myself and I walk in company, and both are very profound experiences. They're also very enjoyable, but you get a lot of satisfaction. There's a sort of narrative in going a long walk, and not knowing quite where you're going to be for the night. It's just very exciting. It's sort of the countryside unrolls and your thoughts unroll, and you get cross with this person and that person, and then you have a meal in the evening and all is well. It's just a very satisfactory way of discovering yourself and a new landscape.
Connections between the natural world, walking and poetry go back a long way. In the simple haikus of 17th century Zen Buddhist Basho.
I'm a wanderer, so let that be my name, the first winter rain.
To the ambling scenes in Wordsworth's poetry, which actually influenced how people thought about the outdoors in the 18th century. Author of Wanderlust, A History of Walking, Rebecca Solnit reads the walking pace into his verse.
Wordsworth is maybe the great poet of walking, that not only do a lot of his poems celebrate walking on foot, including The Great Walk when he was a young man, from Calais on the shores of France to the Swiss Alps on foot, but also he composed on foot. He would go out walking, and if you read a lot of his poetry, that blank verse aloud, you hear that kind of walking rhythm in it.
Sweet was the walk along the narrow lane at noon. The bank and hedgerows all the way, shagged with wild pale green tufts of fragrant hay, caught by the hawthorns from the loaded wain.
Wordsworth walked to compose and refine verses. He considered it part of his work.
Which age with many a slow stoop strove to gain.
From romantics like Wordsworth to today's writers, walking is an attractive metaphor and device.
Walking, I think, is implicit and explicit in everything everyone ever wrote. In the 18th century, many writers in the English-speaking world and in French as well, the literatures I know, begin talking about walking both the city and the country. All nature was a garden you would want to go walking in, as Elizabeth Bennet does. She shows her romantic predilections in Pride and Prejudice by walking with alacrity across great distances. There's a wonderful passage in Pride and Prejudice where she shows up with the hem of her skirt muddy, and the women who see her as lower status and competition, etc. Bingham's sisters make snarky remarks about the dirty hem of her long skirt, and Mr. Darcy remarks that it's brightened her eyes quite wonderfully, I believe.
She has nothing, in short, to recommend her but being an excellent walker. I shall never forget her appearance this morning. She really looked almost wild.
But that book is really interesting because people are negotiating all kinds of distances there, a distance in relationships, a distance in status and things by how and where they walk. Something I didn't realize till I wrote this book, which was such a joy because I'd read Pride and Prejudice so many times before.
To walk 3 miles, or 4 miles, or 5 miles, or whatever it is, above her ankles in dirt, and alone, quite alone. What could she mean by it? It seems to me to show an abominable sort of conceited independence, a most country town indifference to decorum.
In the 19th century, a restless Dickens was said to have walked up to 12 miles a day, musing, observing, and dreaming his way through the tangle of London streets.
The wild moon and clouds were as restless as an evil conscience in a tumbled bed.
Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby, A Christmas Carol.
And the very shadow of the immensity of London seemed to lie oppressively upon the river.
Samwell,
Little Dart,
Jack Bunsby,
A Tale of Two Cities,
Betsy Trotwood,
Great Expectations.
And by the 20th century, walking, particularly in London, and writing about it, had really come into its own. On crowded urban streets, surrounded by strangers, a new form of solitude emerges.
One of my favourite 20th century walkers is Virginia Woolf, who's very cognizant of how her own creative process and the stream of consciousness that both feeds her writing and that she reconstructs in her writing happens on foot. She made up her book To the Lighthouse in a Great Rush, she writes, walking around Tavistock Square in London. But she also writes about walking in a wonderful essay that should be better known called Street Haunting, in which is a kind of mock epic. A character who may or may not be her goes out to buy a pencil on a winter evening, in the course of which she has encounters with all kinds of people and imagines herself in their lives, imagines other parts of her own life, and shows you how much the whole universe can be reached by what goes on in your mind while you wander the streets in search of a pencil.
Let us go then and buy this pencil. But just as we are turning to obey the command, another self disputes the right of the tyrant to insist. The usual conflict comes about. Spread out behind the rod of duty, we see the whole breadth of the River Thames, wide, mournful, peaceful. And we see it through the eyes of somebody who is leaning over the embankment on a summer evening without a care in the world. Let us put off buying the pencil. Let us go in search of this person. And soon it becomes apparent that this person is ourselves.
And we leave the north banks of the Thames to head south across the river to explore the modern capital with walking enthusiast and writer Will Self.
Well, we're standing at the southern end here of Vauxhall Bridge, and it's a tube strike day here in London, so there's a lot of traffic that you can hear booming.
Will has spent years exploring London on foot and has written a lot about walking, particularly in his non-fiction study, Psychogeography.
And I suppose I have a kind of weird fondness for this locale. This is kind of the edge of my manor, and as we look further south, we can see this giant metallic tuning fork, which is the Vauxhall bus interchange, and beyond that stretches South London in all its beauties.
Like many writers, Will immerses himself in an environment to colour his novels.
There are certain kinds of walks I undertake purely for literary purposes. They tend to fall into two categories. One, a lot of my fiction is based in the city, so I will walk in order to get locations and in order to understand a location for something I'm writing.
In Will's novel Umbrella, a character shares a similar discomfort with the man-made world as Will himself.
In his already heightened state, he had looked upon the city as an inversion, seeing the parallelograms of dark woodland and dormant grass as man-made artifacts, surrounded by growing brick, tarmac, and concrete that ripples away to the horizon along the furrows of suburban streets.
And then I do what might be called psychogeographic walking, and I'm particularly preoccupied by the relationship between town and country, and between the idea of the urban hinterland, the bits that we leap over, we avoid. We take a cab or we take some kind of public transport to the airport, and then we fly somewhere beautiful because we don't want to see what's in our own backyard. And what I tend to do is walk through our own backyard lots.
Where are we walking up here, Will? Where are we heading to? We're heading for the bridge by the look of it.
So we'll walk, I think, up and through the St. George's development, which gives us an opportunity to comment on the dreadful impact of international and transnational capital flows on London property, and then on along the river, and I can show you some of the development along the Thames Littoral.
Does it take you a while to settle into a walk in terms of, you know, to sort of shake off the house and sort of relax into something?
The great beauty of walking for the writer is that it's obviously a picaresque. It's a you know, you encounter things, you encounter people, things happen. The walk gives you your narrative. Oh, we've been privileged with an astonishing moment. This, in terms of my personal walking history, you are present at an epical moment.
What's happened?
They have actually opened the River Walk. This is the first time I've come this way, and they've opened the River Walk.
The first time ever?
Yeah.
In your walking experience?
In my life.
What?
You have never been able to walk along this part of the Thames Bank all the way. I don't know when they opened it, but they must have opened it within the last 2 or 3 weeks, I'd say, because I come along here a fair amount. So, oh happy day. And here we've got just moored off the bank is one of these garbage scows, I guess you'd call them in the States, or barges, that pick up at Wandsworth up beyond, further over there to the west, up beyond Battersea Park, and go down continually to landfills in the Thames estuary. So it's the great effluvium of the city. Its rubbish is continually moving down in that way.
Basically, this is a rubbish barge. It's sort of a glorified bin truck, but it goes on the water. Is that pretty much what it is?
Yes. I mean, one of the great, fantastic walks you can do is to walk from Gravesend on the Thames estuary down towards the Isle of Grain in the Thames mouth, which is, of course, across Pip's Marsh in Great Expectations, and indeed where Marlowe tells the story of the Heart of Darkness is in a boat moored just off that bank of the Thames. And when you walk down there, you see not only these orangey-yellow rubbish containers going down to landfills on the Essex and Kent shores, but you also see great freighters full of white goods, I mean, piled up washing machines and dishwashers. They're all going to China where they're recycled. So you get a marvelous sense of the kind of consumer over-sufficiency and redundancy of the culture. The Thames is like, it's fundamentally the gastrointestinal tract of Southeast England. So, you know, you see all of this fundamentally excreta being moved along it.
When I'm thinking of the river, it's making me think of an Olivia Plurabelle, and it's making me think also, as we're walking around here, of one of the most famous literary walks, I guess, which is the walk that's undertaken in Ulysses by James Joyce. I mean, that book also sounds the way it does because a lot of the book is so kinetic. It's about movement. It's about wandering around and observation.
What you can say about the role of walking in Joyce is that he writes about walking on the cusp of modernity, when modernity is actually happening. And when the city is moving, you know, just as you can say there's a modernist moment in prose or there's a modernist moment in painting, there's a modernist moment in the city itself. There's a point in which the spatiality of the city ceases to be defined by physicality and starts to be defined by mechanics in some way. So what's interesting about Joyce's Dublin, as it's depicted in Ulysses, on this day in 1904, is that it's a city in which all of this is going on right then. You've got a tram system, you've got buses, you've got suburban trains, but you've still got people who are largely walking to get around what is, of course, to a Londoner, a fairly compact city. So you have this disjunction between a human-scale city and a mechanical-scale city with the body interposed, and I think that's why it's kind of so evocative for us in that way.
Walk along a strand, strange land, come to a city gate, sentry there, old ranker too, old tweedies, big moustaches leaning on a long kind of spear. Wander through armed streets, turbaned faces going by, dark caves of carpet shops, big man, Turco the Terrible, seated cross-legged, smoking a coiled pipe. Cries of sellers in the streets. Drink water scented with fennel, sherbet. Wander along all day. I might meet a robber or two. Well, meet him, getting on to sundown.
As Leopold Bloom rambles across Dublin in Ulysses, the reader travels with him, following his encounters. Declan Kybert teaches Irish Studies at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. He traces Bloom's journey and what might be guiding it.
Well, he begins walking from his home at 8 o'clock in the morning to buy some meat in the pork butcher's, and he ends up in the cabman's shelter and then bringing Stephen back in the small hours of the following morning. So off and on through the day, he's walked quite a bit. I remember Frank Delaney plotting it on a map and saying it looked very like he was tracing a question mark. I think Dublin was a great city of walkers at that time. I think the greatness of Ulysses is partly that when you walk through streets, you encounter strangeness, the unexpected, including your own strangeness.
So walking allows Bloom to escape and find himself. And as we know, knowledge, in this case self-knowledge, is powerful. Rebecca Solnit, author of Wanderlust, A History of Walking, highlights this power.
These questions of who the space is for, who gets to walk. You know, even in Ulysses, Leopold is roaming endlessly and Molly Bloom is sort of lolling endlessly in her bed. You know, her thoughts certainly roam magnificently and she's having a good time, but she's not moving around in the same way.
I think in some ways, Leopold Bloom is actually trying to escape narrative by walking. Bloom says an Irishman's home is his coffin. If you think in those terms, the people in the streets are probably trying to escape something. They're almost like the living dead, the spirits who have escaped the coffins. And Joyce was always interested in the dead, as we know.
A barren land, bare waste. Volcanic lake, the Dead Sea. No fish, weedless, sunk deep in the earth. No wind would lift those waves. Grey metal, poisonous, foggy waters. Brimstone, they called it, raining down. The cities of the plain, Sodom, Gomorrah, Edom, all dead names. A dead sea in a dead land, grey and old. Old now. It bore the oldest, the first race.
So I think in a way what Bloom is trying to do is not burst in on his wife Molly, who has got a lover in the family bed that day. Bloom doesn't want to be caught up in plot or narrative. He doesn't want to have the part of a revenger in a 19th century melodrama. So walking and thinking and musing to himself is a kind of alternative to all that narrative and emplotment.
A bent hag crossed from Cassidy's, clutching a noggin bottle by the neck. The oldest people wandered far away over all the earth, captivity to captivity, multiplying, dying, being born everywhere. It lay there now. Now it could bear no more.
Ulysses has been so influential that it's difficult to talk about cities, walking and writing without referencing it. Teju Cole is a Nigerian-American author and he is clear about how Joyce has inspired him.
Probably the biggest influence on my writing in terms of style and in terms of the English language is actually James Joyce, just the rhythm, the cadences.
Teju and I met up in New York to walk around Manhattan and peel back its layers through his novel, Open City.
Well, the conceit of the book is that this is a guy who's sort of drawn around by the spirit of the city and he just sort of walks without any particular plan.
These walks, a counterpoint to my busy days at the hospital, steadily lengthened, taking me farther and farther afield each time, so that I often found myself at quite a distance from home late at night and was compelled to return home by subway.
You know, I was in New York City after 9/11, and of course I lived in New York in the years that Open City covers, which is 2006 to 2007. But writing Julius's story, somebody who's not me, someone who's invented, whose life is different from mine, and who goes to different places than I went that year, is a way of repeating that year through the life of a possible other.
In this way, at the beginning of the final year of my psychiatry fellowship, New York City worked itself into my life at walking pace.
So Julius walks as a way of being unstructured, but I make him walk as a way of experiencing the erased or invisible histories of the city.
The intensity of the rain blurred my sights, a phenomenon I had noticed before only with the snowstorms, when a blizzard erased the most obvious signs of the times, leaving one unable to guess which century it was. The torrent had overlaid the park with a primeval feeling, as though a world-ending flood were coming on, and Manhattan looked just then like it must have in the 1920s, or even, if one was far enough away from the taller buildings, much farther in the past.
In a way, writing is very connected to walking for me. So, in a way, writing is a form of rehearsing life, a way of tracing out possible alternatives to what life could be. If we walked down the street the same way we came, it would be the same walk, but not the same walk. So he finds himself walking around downtown Manhattan quite a lot, and through that I'm able to draw out the histories of this part of the city.
Until that moment, I had been a lone walker. But people then began to troop out of the World Financial Center, men and women in dark suits, including a stream of Japanese professionals, who tailed by the rapid stream of their conversation, hurried by me.
And all of those things that are no longer visible, but that are still part of the spiritual atmosphere of the space. My basic idea was that places continue to carry the traces of the things that happened in them, and that those things are available to somebody who has a sensitive intelligence to that particular kind of vanished history.
Before the towers had gone up, there had been a bustling network of little streets traversing this part of town. The commuters with me marched along, shoulders up, heads low, all in black and gray. I felt conspicuous, the only person among the crowd who stopped to look out from the overpass at the sight.
The way slow motion and velocity are actually quite similar. And I feel that moving through the city can be that way. It's like it's dreamy, and all these lives at this slow pace, each person's life on their face, like it's like almost like tree rings. And meanwhile, it's all whoosh, 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 whoosh. There are 16 million of us in the larger metropolitan area. The kind of storytelling that interests me when I write about cities is almost inevitably mystical in that sense. Because what does it mean for 16 million human beings to be sharing space? Not to mention all the people who lived here before us.
As Teju Cole's novel uncovers the history of New York, it's back to London with Will Self to look at how transformation can happen before us as we walk along the Thames riverbank.
We've just come off the main road, past a lot of noise.
This at one point was a slightly wider little laneway, but there's now this new building that's whacked up. And we're going to walk back onto the riverside, where I'm very much hoping there is still Tideway Village, which is this little water gypsy community. And they're now completely surrounded by the balconies of this rather ugly new block. So it's a kind of strange vibe. It's a mixture of how a place can change right before your eyes in the most startling way.
Well, we've ended up here at Tideway Village, is that what it's called?
Yeah, Tideway Village. We're standing on the riverbank, and behind us you can still hear all the hammering and the drilling going on to build these blocks of flats.
Very glassy and multi-sided and...
Luxury flats! It's luxury flats! In front of us are two tightly packed rows of barges and houseboats that are moored between here and a pier that's immediately off the bank of the river. And you know, you can see laundry out on their roofs and little pot plants, and it's a, you know, they're a little community of water gypsies. But if you look to the east, there is the city in all of its concrete, plate glass and steel massivity. So I always like to walk along here because of the contrast. You know, you've got people who are living on these boats who are in a, you know, continually being moved by a natural phenomenon. They're responding to the tide. They're essentially almost in a bucolic context, but they're right in the city. And of course, the city is encroaching you know, really quite massively on their lives at the moment.
And they're all very packed together. They're quite squashed together almost.
They're a village.
Yeah.
They're a village. They're a village in the city.
Will Self has pushed back his chair and moved away from his computer to engage with his city, to experience it, and so to write about it with real knowledge.
You know, if I have any connection with Joyce, it's at the level of the bodily and the visceral and the haptic, the way people hold and touch things. And that's what the kind of urban walking, the urban drifting gives me, is the opportunity to touch things, to touch the moss on this wall or touch the concrete of this embankment and the metal of the balustrade. That's more important to me as a writer than a lot of abstractions.
So as Will Self walks the riverbank in silent protest at change, and the Tideway village asserts its claim to the city, so tomorrow on Bloomsday, hundreds will lay their claim to the Dublin streets. Declan Kybert and Rebecca Solnit sum up the importance of walking the streets and committing it to the page for others to do the same.
I think that many people who dress up on Bloomsday as characters from Joyce's novel may not have read it whole and entire, but they are serious people who are trying to make a point, and that is they're trying to reclaim the streets for themselves and for safety and for the community. And they're aware of the fact that the Dublin of Joyce's day was a place where people felt they owned the streets in ways they may not feel now. So there's a tremendous amount of nostalgia behind all this.
You know, most of us are so busy kind of rushing along with the everyday, keeping up with paying the bills and pleasing our bosses and things like that, that to stop that, to think about something bigger, about the fate of the earth or the suffering of people in another part of the world, and to do something about it is both subversive, not only of the cause of, you know, the system you're opposing, but of the status quo that says, mind your own business, stay busy all the time, move as fast as you can, you know, you're stopping. But you're really shifting into a very different mode of being from what we're encouraged and pressured and scolded into doing every day.
Because most people just live in one bit of the city now. They don't cross it in the way that the characters in Joyce do. They often do their shopping as well as their official working in a suburb. And we're in danger of losing a vision of the city as a whole. And yet the beauty of cities through history is that they are places for what Richard Sennett called the uses of dissent, where you can encounter diversity and suddenly be aware of how strange you yourself are in meeting a total stranger.
Thanks to all of our contributors in that piece on walking and writing, and many of those writers have written extensively on this subject. We'll put all of those books on our website. But in the meantime, A.C. Grayling's The Quarrel of the Age, a biography of William Hazlitt, is published by Wiedenfeld and Nicholson. Margaret Drabble's latest work, The Pure Gold Baby, is published by Canongate. Rebecca Solnit's Wanderlust, A History of Walking, has just been reissued, and her new book on mapping cities, The Faraway Nearby, is also out this month, with both books published by Granta. Will Self's Psychogeography is published by Bloomsbury, and Teju Cole's Open City is published by Faber. Readings in that piece were by Maria Tetche, Daniel Ramsworthy, Regan Hutchins and Declan Brennan, who'll actually be doing a reading of Ulysses tomorrow on Bloomsday at 11 a.m. in the Rowley Saul restaurant, Dundrum. Now, today is Father's Day, and father and son, Anthony and Ben Holden, have compiled 100 poems that make grown men cry, with a very impressive list of well-known writers, academics, filmmakers and musicians picking their favourite sad poems. I went along to hear some of the readings in the National Theatre in London. This is Booker Prize-winning author Ian McEwan reading from An Exequy by Peter Porter.
In wet May, in the months of change, in a country you wouldn't visit, strange dreams pursue me in my sleep, black creatures of the upper deep. Though you are 5 months dead, I see you in guilt's iconography. Dear wife, lost beast, beleaguered child, the stranded monster with the mild appearance, whom small waves tease, Andromeda upon her knees in orthodox deliverance. And you alone of pure substance, the unformed form of life, the earth which Piero's brushes brought to birth for all to greet as myth, a thing out of the box of imagining. This introduction serves to sing your mortal death as Bishop King once hymned in tetrametric rhyme his young wife, lost before her time. Though he lived on for many years, his poem each day fed new tears to that unreaching spot, her grave.
Ian McEwan reading there from an exequy by Peter Porter. The editors of Poems to Make Grown Men Cry are father and son, Anthony and Ben Holden. They told me how the book came about.
It dates back 20-odd years to when two close friends of mine, a few days apart, burst into tears while quoting a poem, which I found very striking and moving, and I thought there's an anthology in this, and they never had time to do it. But a couple of years ago, my son Ben suggested, "That's such a good idea, Dad, let's do it together." So
I always thought it was just a great idea and a fantastic conversation with lots of different angles. So had a eureka moment 2 or so years ago and suggested to Dad it would be fun to try and mount this together as a father and son. It has been great fun.
Evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins takes to the stage to read from a poem that expresses his love of nature.
I'm going to read a poem by A.E. Housman, one of my favourite poets. This one is not from A Shropshire Lad, but it has the same hauntingly wistful air. I knew it by heart as a boy in love, not with any particular girl, but with the idea of being in love, and especially the tragedy of lost love. In my book, River Out of Eden, I had earlier quoted, actually misquoted from memory, the last verse, when I wanted to convey the indifferent callousness of Darwinian natural selection, noted by Darwin himself. I find it all too easy to cry when reading poetry, so I hope I won't let myself down now. It's from Last Poems. Tell me not here, it needs not saying what tune the enchantress plays in aftermaths of soft September or under blanching mays, for she and I were long acquainted and I knew all her ways. On russet floors by waters idle, the pine lets fall its cone. The cuckoo shouts all day at nothing in leafy dells alone. And traveller's joy beguiles in autumn hearts that have lost their own. On acres of the seeded grasses, the changing burnish heaves, or marshalled under moons of harvest, stand still all night the sheaves. Or beeches strip in storms for winter and stain the wind with leaves. Possess, as I possessed a season, the countries I resign, where over elmy plains the highway would mount the hills and shine, and full of shade the pillared forest would murmur and be mine. For nature, heartless, witless nature, would neither care nor know what stranger's feet may find the meadow and trespass there and go. Nor ask, amid the dews of morning, if they are mine or no.
Editor Ben Holden researched the science behind crying for this anthology.
I looked into tears and why we cry during the research of the book and found all sorts of interesting facts out. For instance, we're the only species that cry from the age of 10, although the male tear duct is larger than the female, boys do definitively cry less. And people aren't sure whether that's biological or cultural, probably the latter. And I thought all that was very interesting. And when we are gathered in moments of high emotion publicly, like weddings or funerals, I don't think it's a coincidence that we turn either to music or poetry.
What are the most universal themes? What were the themes that recurred throughout in terms of selections in this book?
There's a lot of wonder about parenthood. I have young children, so I find those poems especially resonant, and the innocence and age of wonder of children.
Well, obviously death looms large, intimations of mortality, but also love, pain. We have three contributors who've suffered the ultimate pain of losing a child. The beauty of nature, there's all sorts of things. It's very interesting.
My name's Melvin Bragg, and I chose Shakespeare's 30th sonnet, which he talks about remembrance of things past and the things that, as we grow old, we regret, and how in the passages of sweet silent thought we grieve for the things we did not done, and we live again the things that we know we did badly, and we live again the suffering that we went through. And it's Shakespeare at his most lyrical and finest. Curiously enough, the last couplet, he becomes commercial, which he can be, and he says, but never mind, you're alive and life is going to be good, and so I'm full of hope. I don't believe a word of it. I mean, he's selling his poem there. The first 12 lines are real Shakespeare. This is what life is really like. And then he pops a couplet on at the end to get it through the post to the intended patron.
The title of the book suggests it's about making grown men cry. Do you think that poetry has a particular power to allow men to, you know, to get a little bit sad, to shed a tear?
I think poetry can and does make people cry, make people weep, if you have that turn of mind. It's like everything else, you've got to be open to it. Otherwise, it's closed to you. It's a two-way activity. The poem reads you and you read the poem.
How do you think that poetry, particularly the poem that you chose, manages to do so in such brevity? This is such a short poem and yet it packs such a punch.
Well, I think how they do it with such brevity is because he's called Shakespeare and he's a genius. When, to the sessions of sweet, silent thought, I summon up remembrance of things past, I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes new wail my dear time's waste. Then can I drown an eye unused to flow for precious friends hid in death's dateless nights, and weep afresh love's long since cancelled woe, and moan the expense of many a vanished sight. Then can I grieve at grievances foregone, and heavily from woe to woe tell o'er the sad account of four bemoaned moan, which I knew pay as if not paid before. But if the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored and sorrows end.
My name is Mike Lee. I'm a filmmaker and a dramatist, and I've chosen a poem by Charles Bukowski, the great American drunken poet, which is called Eulogy to a Hell of a Dame. Some dogs who sleep at night must dream of bones, and I remember your bones in flesh, and best in that dark green dress and those high-heeled bright black shoes. You always cursed when you drank, your hair coming down. You wanted to explode out of what was holding you, rotten memories of a rotten past. And you finally got out by dying, leaving me with a rotten present. You've been dead 28 years, yet I remember you better than any of the rest. You were the only one who understood the futility of the arrangement of life. All the others were only displeased with trivial segments, carped nonsensically about nonsense. Jane, you were killed by knowing too much. Here's a drink to your bones that this dog still dreams about. Well, you know, the brief was poems that make grown men cry. And this is a poem in which Bukowski is lamenting a woman called Jane, who's been dead for 28 years, and whose bones he still dreams of. And, you know, I can relate to that because there are people that I remember who have long since passed on, who I think of sadly and with some emotion. And the poem, accordingly, makes me cry.
Do you think that poetry is a route in for men in terms of like getting in touch with their emotions and maybe shedding a tear?
Well, I think poetry certainly can be, but I suppose if I'm honest, I don't think that's really the issue. I don't think poetry is the issue. I think, you know, I'm in my early 70s and having grown up in that horrible post-war period where you know, we were words like sissy and pansy and control your emotions and all those things were kicking around. I mean, the great news is that it's now, we've moved into the 21st century, and it is easier and better in terms of men being able to express their emotions. I mean, poetry is important and it's part of it, but I just think the whole thing of men being able to not hide behind the mask of male bullshit is very important.
And Poems to Make Grown Men Cry is edited by Anthony and Ben Holden and published by Simon & Schuster. Now we're returning to the streets of Dublin, but 40 years in the future. Zoe Cummins meets with broadcaster and writer John Kelly to find a city in crisis.
In John Kelly's third novel, From Out of the City, things have gotten far worse than we ever could have expected for Dublin.
We're standing here on O'Connell Bridge. From Out of the City is set in Dublin in the future, about 40 years from now. The city has really pretty much gone to seed. Nothing works anymore. The big plot line is that an American president comes to Dublin on a state visit, and while he's here, he gets assassinated.
We all know what happened. A small bang, more of a pop than anything. And the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states slumped sideways onto the deep blue carpet of St. Patrick's Hall.
This event obviously throws the whole city into considerable turmoil and the whole country and the whole world. But while that is a big sort of blockbustery plotline, it is perversely kind of backgrounded all the time by the narrator, who keeps saying, I'm not so much interested in that, this aspect of it. This is not a thriller. He keeps saying this. He's more interested in the individuals involved and what's happening then.
It is an honest and faithful record of breakage and distress at a time of dysfunction. Personal, local, national, global, cosmic, and whatever lies beyond that again. Beyond even the farthest pricks of our increasingly desperate little probes pervade it all. A time when everything was already broken and when, in many ways, the shooting of a president, the actual detail that is, was neither here nor there.
The main drama, I guess, of the book, at least the stuff that doesn't happen in people's heads, does happen in the centre of the city.
Dublin City, in your novel, as the main character, Monk, says himself, is a city of danger, of disease. It's not a pleasant place to be. How did you come up with this sort of foresight for Dublin? Is it inevitable, really, for our city?
I don't know that it's inevitable. The book is set about 40 years from now, and obviously things have got a lot worse in my book. But at the same time, if you work around the city at all, you see a lot of stuff that, if it does get worse, is going to be really bad. I mean, really bad. I've exaggerated certain things, like from where I stand, you know, the Abbey Theatre is gone, it's a car park. That's possible. You know, the Spire, is it gone too? But in terms of the danger, you know, if you walk around this particular part of the city at the wrong time of night, that danger is very palpable. And, you know, you don't need to stand on the O'Connell Bridge for too long to spot that there are people up to no good. The narrator himself lives out in Dunleary. And that narrator doesn't move. He stays in his attic all the time. Doesn't move at all. So he's out there watching over everything. Among the characters that he watches is one particular one who travels in and out of the city randomly all the time.
Schroeder is a name we all know. Anton James. Lived next door to me, adjacent to the right and one of those I monitored. In fact, I'd been watching Anton Schroeder extremely closely on an almost daily basis for a very long time. A whisper. A benign and focused energy willing him to move in this way or that.
We're just rounding the corner here into Fleet Street, and we're just about to pass the Palace Bar, where Schroeder has followed a woman down into the underbelly of the city. Temple Bar has become that. There's grass growing in the streets. There's violence all around. And yet he's dared to go into this area to follow a woman.
It's that male thing. Men doing ridiculous things because there's the potential of some kind of sexual reward. So, you know, men do stupid things.
She stops a little further up the street, and Schroeder is rendered bloodless as she dismounts.
and the grey of the shabby thoroughfare is lit by a band of cabaret flesh.
And he knows he shouldn't be in here because this is almost a no-go area. In fact, it is a no-go area in the future. People don't come in here at all because the buildings are all derelict.
Nobody goes near it unless they want to kill somebody, or else have no strong objections to being killed themselves. In short, the place is lethal. Murders, beatings, knifings, and kneecappings.
You know, there are bonfires burning in the center of it. There's random violence.
The stink gets worse. And glancing into the rancid tunnel of Merchant's Arch, he sees an enormous greyhound nose at a corpse. A bus driver, by the looks of it. But Chantal's heels are click, click, clicking. And the bicycle is tick, tick, ticking. And its broad saddle is all burnished and smooth. And Schroeder follows on.
We're heading up Fountain Street, up towards Central Bank.
Yeah.
And we're still on the cobble streets. But really, in the novel, this is pretty much the worst place in the entire city. What's happened? Yeah. What's happened here?
Everything's just gone to hell, you know. I mean, but the idea of Dublin being in this sort of state probably came from the feeling that was in the air when I started to write it, of everything was just starting to go wrong here, you know. The economy, our politicians, you know, the state the church was in, all the institutions, everything was just like, oh, come on, can this get any worse? So there was a certain sort of white-knuckled despair when I wrote the book, probably. And I tried to turn that into something constructive. I mean, I don't think many Irish writers just at this moment would be in the mood for writing pastoral books about this green and pleasant land just now. So I took it into the future where things are considerably worse and looked for signs of hope and humanity in the middle of all that.
The doings of this parallel universe are best left alone. A place where almost certainly he will get his head in his hands. A place where tougher men than him have been disemboweled in the middle of the day. Perhaps some physiochemical mechanism really is at work. And perhaps everything he has done and thought from the moment Chantal flashed by him on Westmoreland Street really has been entirely beyond his control.
And thanks there to Zoe Cummins. John Kelly's book, From Out of the City, is published by Dorky Archive. John will be reading from his work at the Hay Kells Festival, that's on July 5th, and at the Galway International Arts Festival on July 19th, that's a Saturday. That brings us to the close of this season of The Book Show. Thanks for listening, and if you want to check out any of our episodes, they're available on rte.ie, iTunes and on SoundCloud. Just search for The Book Show. Well, we look forward to bringing you a new season of The Book Show in the autumn, but in the meantime, thanks from me, Sinead Gleeson, from series producer Zoe Cummins, and reporter Regan Hutchins, who's cooked up this final footnote just for you.
In 1965, Vincent Price and his wife Mary published their cookbook, A Treasury of Great Recipes. Yes, that's the guy, the actor, the merchant of menace himself. With a career spanning over 50 years, his demonic screen presence as a vampire, monster, or a crazed doctor curdled the blood of many generations. However, off-camera, the Dark Prince was a dab hand at mustard dressings and stuffed frankfurters. He didn't recoil in horror from a potted shrimp either, as these recipes were drawn from the best kitchens and restaurants all over the world. The book still tops lists of the most sought-after out-of-print titles, but then that's hardly surprising. Vincent Price was always trusted to sink his teeth into something tasty.
The Book Show with Sinead Gleeson was produced for RTE by Zoe Cummins.